Hello and welcome to Q&A Quest episode 407. Unfortunately, to listen to this episode, proxy authentication will be required. I'm your host, terrible computer science jokes, Mike Apps, a.k.a. Wills, and with me as always.
Star of a brand new army, David McGroney, faster.
And yes, this is another We're Tired episode. Because we're tired.
They will grow more common as your hosts say.
Yes, sure. I don't think there's a lot of news last week, was there? I think we were all busy. We were all consumed by Donkey Kings.
I'm still kind of consumed by the post game. But I'm also playing Landgun. Food cutouts. Yeah, no, I'm not aware of any news we would normally bring up. I might be failing to remember something extremely important. Here we are. What you got, Joe? We've got credible sound rumors of a. Of Nintendo Direct coming. That is, by the time they're listening to this, if they aren't Fireminer, who joins in the chat, by the time they're listening to this, that will have either happened or it won't have yet.
Yes. Who knows? Also, you're echoing a little bit on my end.
Well, echo on your end.
Yeah.
You're echoing.
You're echoing.
Is it just me, or is he echoing for you too?
Dave is echoing. Yep.
I didn't even do it. God damn it. Hey, moment.
Introduce yourself, Joe.
Oh, hello. This is Smokin' Joe Gamer, Joe Hanley, and I'm a bit late, but I guess we're starting late, so it's fine.
We are. It's all good.
Yeah. Took a shower, had a late dinner, then my dad called, and then had to do some other stuff, and now I'm here.
Welcome. I feel like this is going to be a relatively shorter episode this week, because we're all going to talk about Donkey Kong, and then we're probably going to be out of material.
Hey, you could... Now? Do I sound you a little can better? Play
yeah,
Donkey
you're
Kong.
Good now.
Donkey Kong, believe, is enough of an RPG that you could be playing it right now on Q&A Quest.
I agree, but I like to hear all the noises and sounds when I'm playing, so I don't really want to have to play it turned down.
Okay, fair enough.
I may play some Shadow Labyrinth, though.
But you don't want to hear that waka waka noise?
I will have it loud enough to hear that. At least.
Yeah, very good. There he is. Alright, I'm going to watch it on your channel, and that way I'll let you know if anybody posts questions there.
Appreciate it. I've been having just the RP Gamer channel up of late, so keeping an eye on the other would be good.
Okay. Before we dive into what we've been playing, I'm going to quickly answer this Fireminer question. What do you think about the news that Capcom and Namco Bandai is testing an RE Lightgun game based on RE2 in British arcades called RE2 Deadshot? I mean, it's not honestly that surprising or that out of the ordinary. I mean, like, this kind of attempt to adapt shooters into lightgun shooters for arcade consumption isn't exactly new. Companies do it every so often. I mean, there's infamous stuff like Half-Life 2 Survivor. So it's not that surprising. I mean, Resident Evil has a long history of light gun games of dubious quality, so it's mildly a curio, but other than that, like, it's not like I'm ever going to see it in a case.
Yeah, and then you had the Umbrella Chronicles and Darkside Chronicles were okay. But this to me comes off as something more similar to like House of the Dead, and I'm all for it if I ever go to another arcade and they have it. I don't know. I'll wait for the console port, I guess. Who knows? If it gets one.
Yeah, do you guys want to, before we dive into the questions, do you guys want to talk about what you've been playing?
Sure.
Donkey Kong.
Donkey Kong.
I finished DK Bonanza, and I'm not going to spoil anything, don't worry, but man, it's epic. You know?
It's a great finale.
The thing is, it's not a difficult game. It's not meant to be difficult. It's fun. But you get towards the end, and it's like, oh, this feels kind of like... you get towards the end, you're like, oh, though, this is a Donkey Kong game. Yep, this feels like DKC2 right now. Okay, that's fine.
There can be games that are easy that are really unfun because they're too easy, and you just feel they feel kind of brain dead.
Yeah, that's true.
I have not felt that at a single point in this game.
No, I think I died maybe four or five deaths for the whole game, and it, you know, one of them was
I was prone to getting very reckless.
Yeah, and
especially
so
in some of the bonus stages, I died a lot.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't count all the times I was saved by a red balloon in a bonus stage, then yeah, only like 4 or 5 deaths. But at one point, I got 99 balloons just because that's the max, and I fell into
red
a
balloons.
Hole. Yeah. And I fell into a hole and died and did not use a balloon for some reason, so I don't know. There are some spots where it won't save you. Just so you know.
Can't believe the intro song for this episode is going to be the Goldfinger version of 99 Red Balloons.
Oh man. Totally is.
Sure.
I'm just leaving advice for Wheels of the Future.
99 Loof Balloons.
So it's an epic finale, very tear-inducing a little bit here and there, you know, and hey, it's great, you know.
It's fun, and it's charming, and it's got a lot of room for creative ways to approach most challenges, and once you finish, a whole bunch more stuff opens up.
They add more bananas to previously visited areas and new...
That's
Bonanza
bananas.
Challenges, the new challenge rooms, and oh boy.
A lot to sink your teeth into.
So I have like 500 bananas, and it's telling me there's a lot more. So, okay. And I got most of the fossils and outfits, but there's still more stuff to do, and I'm sure I will do it. I really enjoyed the game. You know?
It's quite good.
It's worth the price tag, definitely, in my opinion, and you know,
definitely my favorite thing I've played thus far this year.
Yeah, it's hard to argue that.
Yeah.
I've watched the YouTube videos of that song, which I haven't actually seen in game yet, obviously, a bunch of times. It's so good, and listened to a bunch of other tracks in the game.
Yeah, the it's weird because sometimes I'll go a long time without a disc dropping, and then I'll get like 3 of them in one combat encounter.
Yeah, it's very random.
Very random. And sometimes the Butler Rock guy will give you an extra one. Seems like it's more frequent if you spend more money with his various services, but...
The other thing is that once you get to the post game, you have the option of, instead of buying bananas from the chip exchange, you can just buy records.
Oh, that's cool.
Oh, okay. Then I gotta go visit that.
Yeah, that gives you some incentive to keep caring about the banana chips well into the post game.
And I got a tie that increases the chances of sometimes getting 2 chips for 1, you know. And but I got the 2 songs I wanted though. I got the underwater song, Donkey Kong Country, and I got the other one from the Bramble levels in DKC2 with the
Your Breath Symphony.
Yeah, I love that song. So I got my 2 favorite songs, and then I really liked Canyon and the Underground Canyon song. Very, very good music.
Yeah, there's a lot of great music that isn't recycled from any previous game.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just the game is just a complete package. I mean, I could see it getting awards for best game, best family game, best sound design. I mean, do it. Why not?
Yeah, game of the year.
A lot of love.
Yeah.
Definitely my game of the year so far. It's one of those games that, like, you know, I'll have those ruts where I'm just like, man, I'm just not feeling anything right now. And Bonanza is one of those kinds of games that pulled me right out of that. It's just like, now every game feels better just because, like, Bonanza really recharged me.
Yeah. And with Bonanza, it's like, I can keep punching rocks all day. It's fun.
Yeah, I'm not done with it. I'm letting myself just savor the post game. But yeah,
I'm gonna take a quick break and try to play more traditional JRPGs until, you know, for the last 2 days of JRPG July. But yeah,
would
love to do all that post game stuff.
Yeah, I don't think there's any part of the game I would call a weak link. It's just fantastic from top to bottom. And if you don't think that the dance that Donkey Kong and Pauline do whenever you finish a boss that, like, has them both sort of strutting around and then doing the ape chest pound, if you don't think that's the most adorable thing you've ever seen, I don't know what's wrong with you.
You are not human. You have no heart.
I hate to be that guy, but if neither you don't like this ape game, there's something wrong with you.
But yeah, it's just fantastic from top to bottom. I kind of like, I want to talk about it, but I don't want to talk about it too much because, like, there's so much stuff that is just great to see and experience for the first time. Right. So as much as there's plenty more I could say about it, I'm showing some discretion here.
Yes, I'm just a layer where you meet some old friends, and it was a lot of fun.
Yes. So I don't want to spoil anything, obviously, for the person on this podcast who hasn't beaten it, and it's only been out a week. We don't want any major spoilers here.
I've already
seen
one big spoiler.
There's something that all kind of got spoiled for me, like, because I saw just the name of a YouTube video and it was like, nope, don't watch that. And I kind of, something happened and I was like, okay, like, I'm still somewhat surprised by this. But one thing that's cool though, this isn't a story spoiler, basically, like, in the post game, I was able to get a new ability for the Kong Bonanza so that when I do a power punch, the terrain turns into pure gold. That's fun.
That's awesome.
Yeah, in the post game, you unlock additional abilities that you could not get until you'd finished the game.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot of new things to find at that point. I'm going to bring up something that I was, like, blathering about on Blue Sky that I thought was kind of interesting, which was the game by no means feels like a retread of all games, but it loves doing callbacks in one way or another. And there was something I saw that was really interesting to me, because there's a callback to the mechanics of Donkey Kong Country in a very strange way in just how the game functions, which is, in Donkey Kong Country, there's a lot of secrets that rely on you rolling off of a cliff and then jumping to cancel out of that roll, so you, like, get way more clearance on a jump than you would quote unquote be supposed to be able to have.
Yeah.
And you can still do that in Bonanza. It's obviously less required because everything has, like, a weird way of, like, there's always, like, about three or four different ways you could approach a platforming challenge in Bonanza. But you can absolutely, like, do the DKC roll off a cliff and then jump out of the roll as long as you're still in the roll animation.
Yeah, I noticed that. It's a little more subtle, but it's there. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's a purely mechanical callback to DKC. Like, it functions the way that game did, but in 3D.
And it's just kind of neat. It's like, oh, it's cute that they did that. And if you leverage it right, you can make some very strange jumps that feel like they shouldn't be clearable.
Yeah.
There's certain boss fights that are like half fight, half platforming challenge, where I was using that instead of doing something that would have taken longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just neat. Like, I thought it was an interesting way to call back to the prior games in a very subtle fashion.
And by the end of the game, they do expect you to have some mastery over all of the various bonanzas. And it was so cool when I found out you can switch between them. Like, once you trigger a bonanza, you can switch to all the other ones. And there are
points where the game is absolutely expecting you to just jump between bonanzas.
So, like... So the thing is, at one point I just decided to go back to Lagoon and Hilltop layers and just try to 100% them. Although, actually, you don't have to do that. They're like, if there's bananas that you missed, it's like in the post game, you're going to go back to those areas anyways. So don't, and there's going to be new bananas to get. So don't worry about missing bananas so much. But I went back to Hilltop Zone, and through a combination of the snake jump and the ostrich flight, I was able to reach Cranky Kong and listen to his lecture and get a banana. So that was pretty neat. Like, there's, yeah, and that's what I figured out too. Like, there are a lot of bananas, yeah, that I could have gotten when I first visited with only like the Kong bonanza or even no bonanza, but it's like it was actually easier and more fun when it's like, oh, I can just fly over there with the ostrich. Okay, cool, let's do that. I like that a lot. Yeah, there's,
you have a lot of options.
Yeah, just so many different ways to approach situations. And really, like, the difficulty is adjustable. You know, if you want it to be harder, then you just don't get extra hit points and apple juice. That's all. But of course,
you've got plenty of other things to spend your skill points on anyway.
But I've now seen this picture where somebody found out if you keep dying in the same spot, the game will create a golden Donkey Kong statue of him in an agonized expression, you know, in his death throes.
One of the most horrifying things I've ever seen.
Yeah, but I look at the screenshot, I'm like, okay, well, you only have 3 hearts and no apple juice. You've saved up 32,000 gold and 400 banana chips. What the hell are you doing? Like, maybe it's a low percent
speed
run.
This has to have been done on purpose. Like, they were trying to... And, like, that will get hard, because by late game, you do fight a lot of enemies that can do 2 or 3 hearts in one hit.
Yeah, and I'm like, so that's what I mean. Like, yeah, you can make the game hard for yourself if you want to, but I mean, I was already, I felt adequately challenged in that final layer, you know? And
yeah,
like,
you do get some, like, the equipment you can find ends up doing some really useful stuff. Like, there is equipment that really can change how you approach certain areas.
Yeah, you eventually get an item that turns lava into rock when you touch it, and of course there's all the different britches that will give you reduced damage from various sources that you can freely switch between those.
Yeah, but they have different uses.
But that screenshot to me, I'm just, I don't know why it made me so angry, but I'm just like, if you keep falling into the same lava pool with only 3 hearts and no apple juice, you're gonna fucking die. Like, come on.
It's one of the most horrifying things I've ever seen. It's beautiful.
The game's only hard if you play it wrong, stupid.
Don't be like this. Let's see. Okay, I want to hit some of these questions that are popping up in the chat. So, recently, there's been a number of one-to-one SNES ports of NES games, with the latest one being Castlevania 1. Have you tried any of them? Not personally. And were they to come out in the 90s like the Ninja Gaiden trilogy did, how well would they do? If they were sold individually, terribly. Like, I don't think there was a lot of appetite for just an individual port from NES to SNES. I don't see that having had much of a market. They're interesting as programming challenges. They can have some mild enhancements, but, like, I think it would have been a hard sell to consumers in 1992 to sell Castlevania 1 to them instead of just Super Castlevania 4. And, like, you know, you get things like Ninja Gaiden Trilogy, and, like, that's three games packaged as one, and there's, I mean, continual debate about whether that's a particularly good package, but then you get stuff like Super Mario All-Stars, which made a lot of sense to an extent as a pack-in game, which is where it saw most of its sales, to my understanding. But also, like, that had, at least in the U.S. and, you know, in English-speaking territories, that had a broader appeal because it also had a Mario game you couldn't get before. Like, you at least had the Lost Levels packaged in with it. If you're just, like, you know, putting... If, say, there was just, here is a one-to-one port of Mega Man 3 on Super NES. Maybe it has less slowdown and less flicker, but you're still spending like $50 on it. I mean,
well, plus they, I guess I would the, say, they put the Wily Wars on Genesis and it was meh.
Yeah, but I'm mostly just saying, like, I'm just pulling out examples of things that I could do this with, but, like, you know, and Nintendo itself did a few things that are kind of this. There's a broadcast to Teleview version of Legend of Zelda 1 that's kind of a remake of Zelda 1, has some differences. But, you know, like, it's one of these things where, like, I don't think there was an... Like, video games... The oldest part of the video game consumer market that came in with the NES at that point was, like, 14. Like, there was not really a lot of play for retro, like, was not a broad appeal to the consumer audience. Like, you can't really sell retro until there is an audience old enough to miss things.
Right.
There wasn't much one of those, but, like, say that someone, like, to pull another example, say that there was a re-release of Contra on the SNES. It was just a revised version of the original NES version, like, mostly the same, but maybe less flicker, better frame rate. Would that have sold? Ask Sega how well Sonic X Shadow Generations on Switch 2 is selling. Where you get something that, like, here's a late port that is technically better, but costs a lot given that you quite possibly already bought it. I think it would be... a harder sell than it is now.
Well, Sonic Generations in particular, I bought the PC version when it came out, and that had good frame rate, had good graphics, you know, it was much better than PS3, Xbox 360, but then the 360 version was X enhanced anyway, so it's 4K 30, I think. And it's so to me, Sonic Generations was like, well, wait, didn't you kind of already update that game? And if you're only adding maybe a couple hours of new shadow content, it's like, I'm not paying $50-$60 for that. Screw that.
But, like, yeah. I think broadly, like, you look at something like, to put it another way, like, I have Sonic X Shadow Generations on Switch because it's just like, well, I want to play this portably, and so sure. I'll pick this up. And then, you know, like, you know, most of a year later, here's Sonic X Shadow Generations as a Switch 2 launch title, and that's, you know, 1080 and 4K 60. Like, I'd pay $10 for an upgrade. There's no upgrade.
No.
So we are at that one-to-one, like, the experience you'd have gotten purchasing a slightly enhanced Super Nintendo port of a Nintendo game. And, you know, like, you bulk because it's just like, okay, yeah. But the version I have is not ideal, but I don't like what you're offering isn't good enough.
I feel like you've got to wait at least two console generations before doing like a remaster, you know, like
we've seen companies try to push that, and it does become like, if it's the next generation, chances are their current hardware can still play their old version.
Yeah.
Which would make this trickier.
And the thing is, like, PS3 had a lot of PS2 remasters, and you try to play them now, and you're like, what did you even do? Mm-hmm. I don't see it, you know? And then I always talk about The Last of Us Part 1 on PS5. It's like, that's a remaster. I still enjoy the game. Yeah, the graphics are better, but you didn't do anything. You didn't justify the $70 price tag. You dropped the entire multiplayer mode as well. So what the fuck, Sony? You know?
When I look at those, I think one of the, like, when, so there's two things that I think of when I, like, I know The Last of Us Part 1 is kind of a well-trod topic, but I do want to think of, bring up two things that I think of whenever I think of it. The first is, when I look at Last of Us for PS4 and Last of Us Part 1 for PS5, when I see them side by side, I can say, yeah, they look different. I'd have trouble saying one looked particularly better than the other.
That's true, yeah.
They look different. Like, it's clear that someone went back and redid tons of model and lighting and environmental details. But if you just told me, like, which one of these looks better, I would say, I don't know, they look... Like, one of them might look a little better than the other, but, like, despite looking different, they don't... There's not a huge appreciable improvement. And the other thing I would say is that you're battling not the original game, you're battling what people remember the original game looking like. And with a game like Last of Us that looked as impressive as it did, that means that, in general, it holds up very well in people's memories. And so, yep. Last of Us Part 1, to fully justify itself to returning players, needed to look a lot better to make that difference feel more real. And it's not great at doing that. Ultimately, where I would suspect it found success, I've never looked for sales data, I'd imagine it sold fine. Where I would suspect it found success was people who hadn't played the game but had watched the show.
Right.
But ultimately, like, it was a perplexing remaster.
Yeah, and then when they did The Last of Us Part 2 remaster on PS5, it was a $10 upgrade for me, and it's like, yeah, I'll pay it, that's fine. And
that makes a little more sense.
And it was just like, if you play in performance mode, it looks as good as the original did at 60 FPS, but then you have to play in quality mode for it to look slightly better, and then you're at, you know, much lower frame rate. And so that's the other thing with Last of Us Part 1. I ended up getting the PC version, and if you've got decent hardware, you can really see the full potential of that game. You can really balance things out, and it supports DLSS, FSR, and ray tracing and all this other cool stuff that, you know, you'd have to play at 30 FPS on a PS5. So that's the other thing I thought was very stupid about it. You know, it was an unnecessary remaster, but then you put it on a console that can't actually run everything, you know, maxed out at 60, and it's like, well, that's kind of, I don't know, didn't sit right with me.
It's a weird thing to do to a then still fairly recent piece of hardware.
Yeah. The other thing I wanted to say was, I did try to, like, Battletoads on NES, I can beat the Turbo Tunnel, okay? I tried to play the Genesis version, and I don't know.
Version's weird.
Yeah, I don't know if it's the physics or what, but I just cannot beat the Turbo Tunnel in the Genesis version.
Yeah. Funnily enough, that Genesis version of Battletoads...
Yeah.
Might have been ported by Arc System Works.
What?
But
that's bizarre.
Yeah, it's very strange. They were a contract developer at the time, obviously. The other thing I was gonna say about it was this does remind me that we actually have a mildly interesting piece of news.
Oh, can I say one other thing? Is I didn't find out until, like, last year, or actually, no, maybe it was earlier this year, The Game Boy Advance versions of Mario 2 and 3 are different. And yeah. Mario 2 yeah. is much better on Game Boy Advance. You can save your game like you could in, you know, Doki Doki Panic. And it's like, wow, like, what a difference. This is like, pretty good. And then Mario 3 got all the extra levels added to it in that version. So that's maybe two examples of them re-releasing something on slightly better hardware. It's just like, oh, okay, they actually did a good job with this. So
yeah, they went back. The nice thing with the Mario 3 bonus levels is that they were basically impossible to get, especially in the U.S., because of multiple factors. The first was that the U.S. Never got official releases of all of the e-reader cards.
Right.
There were a bunch of level packs that didn't make it here. The other thing was the Mario 3 cartridge itself does not have enough expansion space to store all of the e-reader levels. It can only store like 3/4 of them at any given moment. So when they re-released it on Wii U Virtual Console and Switch Online, they went ahead and hacked it so that it could store all of the e-reader levels at once.
Okay.
Which is kind of interesting. So there was a little bit of news that I thought was interesting and relevant to what we were saying. Sony threw up a job listing for a senior director of multi-platform and account management. Which specifically calls out that their job will be reporting to the VP of commercial management, critical leadership role in shaping and executing global commercial strategy for PlayStation Studios software titles across all digital platforms beyond PlayStation hardware, including Steam, Epic Game Store, Xbox, Nintendo, and mobile.
There you go.
So they are staffing up to go further into their multi-platform endeavors. It will be interesting to see what ends up in that bucket.
Yeah. Is there really any point in porting this Series X at this point?
They're putting Helldivers on there. They want to get as many users logging into the PlayStation ecosystem as possible. And hardware-wise, PS5 to Xbox Series X ports are relatively simple.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. Okay.
What were you saying, Wheels?
I was going to say a lot of that could be stuff like MLB The Show.
MLB definitely, but they already do that every year. You don't need a big new senior lead on that to do something you're already doing.
Well, sports games. I think Sackboy: A Big Adventure.
I said maybe they're going to do one of their sports games.
Sackboy would honestly probably make sense. Sackboy or Astrobot.
I'd say, yeah, those are perfect additions for Switch 2, in my opinion.
Switch 2. Don't put that dream in my brain.
Yeah, I would lose my mind if they did that. I would suspect we see that on PC before we see it anywhere else.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's true.
The thing is that Astrobot.
I bet that would outsell. It would outsell the PS5 version and Switch 2.
Plausible. The other thing about Astrobot is just that depending upon when they launch it, but the other thing I would say about Astrobot is that it's already a giant PlayStation advertisement. You don't need to advertise to the people you've already sold to.
Yeah.
Inculcating PlayStation nostalgia is half of what that game is meant to do. So honestly, it does kind of make sense that at least a PC release.
But what if they added Switch 2 exclusive content that brings in Mario Bot, Luigi Bot?
Delete that from your brain. It's not happening.
Okay.
It is interesting. Like, I suspect that leading this charge will be their live service games. Like, that is the biggest thing, because that most directly tunnels back to them.
Destiny and Switch 2.
But I wouldn't be surprised if we see some of their other stuff. Like, we saw Lego Horizon Adventures. Find its way to Switch, because that was a family-friendly title that allowed them to sort of advertise their core franchises.
Is that going to get a Switch 2 port, maybe?
I don't think it sold that well. Is the problem? I don't think it sold well on anything. Is the problem?
I don't know what that wouldn't like. It's a Lego game. I don't think that would do that much for it. I mean, it already runs fine on Switch 1. It probably runs fine on Switch 2. You don't.
Yeah, I don't see them having much incentive to go back and update it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's one of those things like that I would think is also the kind of title that might find its way relatively quickly to other platforms. It's just something that functionally is an advertisement for their really expensive games that like their really expensive games are probably going to start turning into timed exclusives to the PS5 just because like okay, that drives a quick hardware bump, and then we put it on another platform to recoup the cost of producing an ungodly expensive video game. I suspect that we're going to see that repeatedly occurring with some of these finding their way primarily to PC, but if they especially if they have a live service component, they'll probably be more giddy to push them to any platform they think they can get them to work on.
All right, now stop me if this sounds crazy, okay?
Oh, no.
Imagine you have a very expensive license that you have exclusively.
Oh, God, are you you're asking for Spider-Man?
Yes.
Yes, Spider-Man on Switch. Yes.
What I'll say is Spider-Man found its way to PC. Like, that's what I would say is that, like, I think we'll continue to potentially see, we might see some of those find their way to non-PCs. I would suspect that what we'll see, especially to start with, is we might see them find their way to other hardware if there's a new one to advertise. So, like, Spider-Man 1 found its way to PC around the time that they were really building up to Spider-Man 2 on PS5. Because there it functioned as, hey, you can play... you can play... Spider-Man... you know, right now on your... you can play this... and get excited for this new one that's going to cost us $1 million billion. And then, you know, of course, Spider-Man 2 did find its way to PC. It just took a little while. And I think we might start seeing that for, certainly for PC and Xbox as being the strategy going forward. You get the big, you get the big juice of sales right at the start, and then, you know, 6 months down the line, that's when you release your port to, you know, PC, Xbox, maybe Switch 2 if it can handle it. You know, stagger those out a little bit so that you can continue getting juice out of each subsequent release. That would be my guess for what their strategy ends up being. But yeah, it's interesting, just like, you know, they are hiring for a very senior reports to the C-suite person whose job is just managing their multi-platform strategy, which, yeah, indicates at least some degree of expansion of that strategy. I think most recently we've seen Helldivers 2 launch on the Xbox. Like I said, I expect that live service games are going to be the first and fastest to come out on other platforms.
Makes sense.
Do you think they'll put Halo do you think Microsoft would put Halo Infinite on PS5?
Wouldn't we rather have Master Chief Collection?
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, speculating.
The current set of rumors have kicked around both Master Chief Collection and Infinite, so I wouldn't be surprised.
And there's a rumor that there might be a new Halo in 2026 or something.
Oh, we know that there's a new Halo they're working on. They've been showing off that they've switched to Unreal.
Okay. Gotcha.
We just don't know when it's coming out. I think 2026 is probably a little too early, but we'll see.
And I just have no desire to give any money to Microsoft right now, though.
Yeah, no, I don't blame you. I don't particularly want to either. But
if they would put out, if Series X got like a really cool looking exclusive game, yeah, I'd buy it. But
yeah, that's not it.
Nope.
Like apparently, like Forza Horizon is doing ungodly numbers on PlayStation at this point. Like
I heard that.
Like yeah. I'd suspect Forza Horizon is going to show up on as many things as they can fit it onto. I mean, if they put it on Switch 2, I won't lie, I'd be tempted. Like, that's the kind of racing game I can enjoy.
4 was better, though.
Yeah, but, I mean, just Forza Horizon as a concept is more in my taste than the sadly departed Motorsport variant of the franchise.
Yeah, that was just a simulator. I don't care for those. Yeah.
Yeah, well, they just killed it. It's branch gone, of the franchise is dead.
Doesn't matter anyways. Okay.
RIP turn 10. But yeah, like, it's a fascinating, we live in strange times.
We do, yeah.
To put it another way, like, if you had told basically anyone of 20 years ago that Nintendo would be the last console manufacturer that is still balking at putting their titles on any other console, I don't think people would have believed you in the midst of the GameCube era. But we live in strange times. To hit another one of these questions, someone is trying to translate all of Eldorado Gate on the Dreamcast. I don't even remember those games existed. I mean, they only kind of barely did. For those who are not aware, Eldorado Gate was a, like, episodic RPG, released bimonthly, in, what ended up being 7 releases in Japan, from October 2000 to October 2001. For the Dreamcast, developed and published by Capcom. It had artwork by Yoshitaka Amano. And I want to say that whatever came out of that was supposed to be much longer at some point. Like, I think that they ended up seeing that the sales were not there to make as many volumes as they had anticipated. My understanding is that they kind of pivoted midway through and shrunk the story down to be something a little more manageable. Very strange early attempt at episodic video games. The fact that they managed to release 7 volumes inside of a full calendar year is insane. I cannot imagine, like, that is a lot of logistical hurdles to get through. And of course, by the time that they closed it, they closed the whole thing, Dreamcast was long since discontinued. Like Sega had announced it was going third party in like February 2001. The Dreamcast itself had been, at least in the U.S., marked down to like $50 to just get out remainder stock by July of 2001.
Hmm. You mean I could have gotten a Dreamcast for $50? Wow.
That's how I got one.
I just never had any interest in the console for some reason. I loved the Saturn, but then I got the N64, and then I got the GameCube, and then I didn't care about Dreamcast. Yep.
You got the N64 after Dreamcast?
No, after Saturn.
Oh, okay. After Saturn. Okay.
And then got the GameCube because I wanted to play Smash Bros. Melee. And yeah,
if you go back and look at news stories, it's a little fascinating that they to watch as they, like, they're just trying to run out the stock. The last official Dreamcast games in the U.S. come out, like, the last ones, like, that Sega has any party to, they all kind of come out by summer of 2001. There's a handful of there's a handful of games that end up sneaking out all the way into like September, October, but they're very few and far between. They're games that you don't remember, like Ooga Booga.
Good old Ooga Booga.
Do you actually remember Ooga Booga?
No, I have no idea what that is.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
And the profoundly cursed Floygen Brothers Episode 1. There is no Floygen Brothers Episode 2. From the company that would one day bring you WWE 2K25.
Seriously? Visual Concepts game?
Yeah.
Well, that's hilarious.
The thing I've brought this up before, but the thing I'll always remember Floygen Brothers for is like a story on an ancient EGM podcast where they were talking about how they had gotten someone, like, they gave that game a profoundly negative review because it sucks, and someone from like someone high up in Visual Concepts apparently had like called the magazine, like it called like their business line and started cursing them out.
Wow. But, hey, you made a turd. That's your fault.
Floygen Brothers was regrettable. But it was supposed to be like, I don't know, there was like a push to try to make episodic content happen here, because Floygen Brothers obviously was also supposed to be an episodic game. Each new Floygen Brothers game building upon the previous, much less charming than El Dorado Gate, I'm not gonna lie to you. But yeah, I know very little about the actual content of El Dorado Gate. I might go looking at those fan translations to see what those end up being like, but I'll probably wait until more of them are done.
Yeah, well then, speaking of Capcom, though, Resident Evil Revelations, they had, you know, the game itself was kind of structured as if it were multiple episodes, even though it was just one game. But then Revelations 2 obviously had like six different chapters. But then, you know, now on a Steam sale, you can get the whole package for $5. So.
I mean, like, yeah. Revelations 2 felt like a game that they had essentially completed and then divvied up. Just to experiment with, like, could they sell these shorter chapters over a longer period? And then, like, because I think it was like a month and a half later, they had released all of the episodes on a disc. Okay. Like, it was very short. Like, it was, like, what kind... I think they were just kind of trying to see what kind of response they would get to releasing a game. Like, will that first a whole lot more will...
Well, then the first episode had been free, though, right? And then...
Something like that. But it was one of those things, like, what's the buy-through on people who download the first episode, that kind of thing.
Right.
I think that was kind of what they were trying to experiment with, and the fact that they never did it again leads me to believe that, like, whatever results they saw, they weren't particularly compelling.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's the last instance I'm aware of that happening, and it wasn't even a success. Yeah,
episodic gaming makes more sense as a concept if you're looking at something that is digitally distributed. Physical distribution of episodic games is a nightmare.
Yeah,
like, just because, like, is the series picking up steam? Is it not? Like, is the first episode the most you're ever going to sell? If for some reason you're selling more units per episode, how do you disseminate the old ones? Do you do what triggers you pulling another manufacturing run on them? Like, you know, I as someone who was a sucker for the .hack games, anyone who has ever attempted to purchase the first four games will realize that they just made less and less copies of each of them. Until you get to part four, the conclusion, which is extremely expensive because they didn't make that many of them, because it was only selling to people who had played parts one through three.
Then PS3 had a game called Siren Blood Curse, I think it was called.
Yeah, Blood Curse.
Yeah.
Which was the meta-net textual, like, Japanese developer makes a remake of their horror game, but frames it like a Western remake of a Japanese horror movie. Blood Curse is really strange.
Yeah.
But that game, yeah, it was episodic on PSN, and then it was sold in Japan and Europe as just, here's all the episodes on Blu-ray disc. Part of the reason they tried that was also that original Siren on PS2, both Siren 1 and 2, are functionally, like, split into missions. They're very easy to divide. Siren 1 is a very obnoxious game to play. That is a horror game with fucking stealth escort missions.
Oof, sounds disgusting.
It's bad. It does not feel good.
I struggled really bad in Metal Gear Solid 5 when you have to escort all those kids. It's like, oh god, that was awful.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, now imagine doing that in a game that controls like ass.
Right. And that was a good game, and that was the one mission where I'm just like, it took me forever to beat it. But then once I did, you know, then I got to the mission where there's the guy who's made of fire, and then that's when it clicked. Like, oh, that's why they were trying to give me a squirt gun. I guess I have to replay the whole freaking mission now. Yeah. So
the other thing to note about original Siren's horrible stealth escort mission is if the child is spotted, the game is over.
Oh. Oh, no. No.
Yeah, it's not great. Not a fan. I tried to play through Siren about 7 years back, and that broke me. I could not break through that mission. But yeah, it's a weird game. It's interesting. I would never pretend that it was not an interesting game. I think it's very, very bad, but it's very, very interesting at the same time. Maybe a game that's easier to watch than to play.
Real quick, our wheels in your chat room. You got one of those spammers, cheap viewers on blibbity blah.
Oh, yeah. Let's buy some viewers.
Yeah. Woohoo.
Okay. A quick one. I once asked about people having fun seeing their Sims avatar screw up and die horribly. Is there any life simulation that actually lets you, as a third person, manage a barely functional person such as an alcoholic? What if you can play the same role as Ozzy Osbourne's wife to him? I would posit that there's nothing that's quite this, but there are a few games that are a little like this, depending upon how generous your interpretation. Pac-Man 2 The New Adventures, aka Hello Pac-Man, is you trying to influence an extremely stupid, neurotic Pac-Man to do things.
That's a stupid game.
Another one I would bring up that is one that I'm personally fond of is a game called Romania. Romania number 203. Which was a weird Dreamcast era Sega game. I believe it also had a PS2 port. Where you were kind of like this weird invisible, I don't know what the in-game explanation for what you were to this man was, but you're kind of just trying to get this shut-in nerd to, like, fucking, get a life by doing weird shit to him, moving his furniture around, reading his diary to figure out like what his ambitions are that he's not going through with. It's a weird game. It's an interesting game. But that's like, he's not like fully dysfunctional, but it is a game where you're kind of going in and trying to influence his life for the better, even though he's kind of a weird shut-in.
Yeah, well, it might sound weird, but what I liked about The Sims 4 was that I could just kind of hit play and just sit back and watch and didn't, you know, there's times where it didn't require much input. And you can just get some popcorn and just see what they do. And occasionally, yeah, they'll yell out for help and you just click a few things. So I don't know. I kind of like the fact that things were really automated in that game. I don't know. That's just me.
Octodad's probably something I have in mind, but that game is about overcoming the challenge. What if you just want to watch someone crash and burn in a funny way? I think that's kind of what The Sims just turns into.
Yeah.
You wouldn't need to script that. In fact, it would be suddenly become very depressing if you scripted it. The emergent helplessness of The Sims is part of what keeps that funny.
But the funniest thing about Octodad is just that the wife doesn't know.
Nobody expects
the thing. Right. But then the sushi chef at the supermarket is like, Octopus! I got you! That is great.
And Boo, what's the matter with you?
Yeah.
But yeah, like, I mean, with as far as like that goes, like, Octodad, there's always the fun additional interpretation of Octodad as like, oh, he's not an octopus, he's just a normal dude. He's just got imposter syndrome. But, you know, that's getting into the weeds. But yeah, I think that there are, like, if you're watching someone, like, crash out, I think you're probably going to have more fun with it being emergent. Whereas, like, the second you start scripting it, it kind of, like, either has to go into full farce or it becomes the most depressing thing in the world.
I tried to make myself in The Sims 4, and everything looked just like my apartment. He had my same hobbies and interests and personality traits. And then he gets rejected by a married woman, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's okay. You know, this is just very depressing. I can't play this anymore. So... No, to be fair, he didn't know before he asked her out.
Yeah, I would hope so.
that's what I meant. Yeah, okay.
Fireminer, in response to something we'd been talking about earlier, saying one-to-one ports have their place. There are people who prefer the Switch port of Dark Souls 1.
Our favorite one-to-one port.
I prefer
that remaster.
Yeah, that's not even a one-to-one port because it runs more consistently than PS3.
Yeah, but I mean, broadly speaking, if you're looking at like what people would consider a quote-unquote one-to-one port, like improve the performance is usually not considered to be outside the realm of a one-to-one port. But what I'll say about that is, I generally do as well, but I think in the context of when this question might have been asked, my suspicion is that it was asked when we were talking about NES to SNES, is I don't think that there was a huge appetite for like the old game but running better among the children of 1992.
Yeah, the Switch ported Dark Souls is the best version.
It's definitely the way that I would play it, simply because, like I said, I don't much care for a lot of the choices that the remaster made in terms of changing the game's lighting and general look.
I just wish I had gotten that Praise the Sun amiibo. God damn it.
It's so good.
Rapid. Arc System console port, or ASW console ports in the 90s were weird. The PS1 version of the original Guilty Gear has horrendous sound, looks ugly, and runs terribly. I mean, like, that game is already Kusoge in its best form. I mean, that is the game where you can combo into the instant kills.
Yep.
So, like, Guilty Gear the Missing Link matches and stupid all the time.
Yeah, I got I bought whatever version was on Switch. Like, I don't know if it was just a direct arcade port of Guilty Gear 1, but that's just threw me off. I'm like, so like the entire second round, you know, the computer is trying to insta-kill me like 5-6 times, and it's like, you gotta be kidding me. Yeah. Just comes out of nowhere. I barely beat that game one time because of the fucking computer and the insta-kills. Ugh. Sorry.
Yeah, I can't even find... I've never seen a cabinet for Guilty Gear The Missing Link. I have absolutely zero knowledge of what that might have looked like in an arcade.
Yeah, and then
yeah.
Eventually they got what, Guilty Gear XX Accent Core Plus R, something like that.
There's a bunch of games in between those, but yeah. Guilty
that's
Gear,
good. Yeah,
Gear
that
X,
one was good.
Guilty
but...
Gear X Flash, Guilty Gear X Flash 1.5, Guilty Gear XX, Guilty Gear. I love these.
But anyways, if you want to play that, just get the newest version.
Accent Core Plus R is the one that people remember.
Yeah, right.
Okay. The updated versions of Guilty Gear X2 were in no particular order. Guilty Gear X2 Sharp Reload. Guilty Gear XX Slash. Guilty Gear XX Accent Core. Guilty Gear XX Accent Core Plus. Guilty Gear XX Accent Core Plus R. And then you get some weird ones like Judgment and Isaka.
Yeah.
Which use a lot of the same assets, but aren't strictly speaking... they aren't strictly speaking the same. It's... Man, there's so many of those. That franchise was the franchise had a productive mid-2000s, I'll put it that way.
Yeah,
has anyone here
Drive just has a 5-hour movie as a story mode and then just had like survival and arcade. Yeah, I always wish that Strive had gotten more content or like a Blaze Blue style story mode, but oh well. You can play as Dizzy now.
Oh, yeah. So what you're saying is you hoped they would strive for better.
Yes, indeed.
I would not assume that Arxis is going to do anything but primarily a visual novel for story modes, unless there is a significant push by them to claim otherwise.
Well, it wasn't even a visual novel, it was just a movie. Like, it was literally a movie that you watch. You don't press anything.
Broadly, yeah. It's just going to be non-interactive.
Yeah.
Has anyone here remaster?
Tried the what?
Patapon remaster.
Oh, no. Those games always look stupid to me.
They're kind of cute. I haven't gotten around to the remaster.
And having said that, though, I loved Loco Roco. So Patapon looks stupid, but then I played Loco Roco and I was like, oh, this is awesome.
I'm not having to juggle between two different platforms anymore. It will get more with games from the new 3DS. How is the calculation for third-party developers? I mean, it's going to come down to how it ends up selling. It's doing pretty well so far. We'll see. But, I mean... Most developers try to put things on everything. That's just become more and more the norm. In my country, the market for used Switch One is still pretty hot, but I know for a fact that tons of people exclusively pirate Switch games. Yeah, I mean, part of the promise with new platforms at this point is the promise of we will incorporate more ways to make sure people can't just pirate your games. But what I'll say is, like, part of the value proposition for third parties is that the Switch 2 gives them another platform to put a game on that will not require them to essentially re-engineer it from scratch. Like, even though the Switch 2 is going to be much weaker than your Xbox Series X or PS5, it's still within a ballpark that people can work with, and it has a lot of modern GPU features that games tend to rely on now. So if a game just doesn't make sense on Switch One, like the cost to re-engineer it just doesn't make any sense, like that's when you just make it a purely Switch 2 game. Like that's broadly going to be it. Like, you're going to see Switch 1 versions of games for a long time, but you'll also see that, like, Switch 2 only games are going to just sort of end up happening because you could spend 2 years engineering a Switch 1 version that comes out and then doesn't even run that well. Or you could spend, you know, closer to a year making a Switch 2 version that, like, isn't going to look as good as the PS5 version, but will be comparable and not require your entire team to, like, you or some, more likely some third party porting house to essentially sacrifice someone's firstborn child to make this object function. So I think that's going to kind of end up being the calculus. But ultimately, if you can get it running on Switch 1, then, you know, you can also just put it on Switch 2 and, like, maybe charge a little more for it, or have it as a value-add proposition of, like, hey, if you get it on one, you get it on the other, and when you get it on your Switch 2, whenever that happens, it's going to run a lot better, so you kind of get a lot more value, and thus we can sort of put that in the value proposition. You're starting to see that with stuff like Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 3 and 4, or No Man's Sky, that sort of thing. I think you'll sort of see that going through broadly. But also, you know, you get things like WWE 2K25 just came out, and there was one attempt to put that franchise on the Switch, WWE 2K18. It's an infamous disaster, runs horribly, takes forever to load. There's a reason that they just didn't even try again. Like, that was not considered to be worth their time. Switch 2 comes out, 2K25... looks and plays pretty comparably to any other version that you could get.
Yeah, it looked fine to, like, me when I was watching it.
No, yeah. It's great. Yeah, no, great port.
It's an excellent version.
It appeared to be 60 even when there were like 8 guys in the ring, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, it's 60. It basically never drops frames. Like, it's a good port.
And real quick, not to be mean, but, like, towards the end of Bonanza, it's like, oh boy, there's too much stuff on the screen.
Nintendo was pretty clear about, like, yeah, they had internally, they seemed to be debating, like, there are two kinds of things that can cause it to really chug. And I think it's entirely, like, it looks like it's chugging more than it is because it's a double buffer V-Sync. So when it starts dropping frames, it drops, like, its frame rate cuts in half. Which gives it the appearance of chugging a lot worse than it does. But from what I can tell, like, essentially Nintendo internally was just, like, and they mentioned this in interviews, like, they were aware of the problems, and their options were to limit the amount of carnage on screen, or to let the frame rate sometimes it'll do that. And they decided that, you know, sometimes the frame rate doing that, sometimes the frame rate doing that was worth it for the bringing across the spectacle that they wanted. It seems to be CPU limited in this case.
But, like, I wasn't angry about it. I was laughing hysterically, like, because there was so much shit on the screen, and I'm like, okay, yeah, honestly, you know what? Well played. You know what? This is what it takes to slow you down.
I see why it did that. Like, one thing you can say for it, when it starts to drop frames, you're never confused why it did it.
No.
Like, it's always because something absolutely bananas is happening on screen.
Pun intended.
But yeah, it is.
And again, I can't spoil anything, but there's a part where I'm just like, wow, I can't believe this is, like, not crashing right now.
Like, the machine should be sputtering and dying. Yeah. Fireminer saying, don't get me started on DSi exclusive games. Oh, man. Like, I'm not sure which is the sadder set of games, DSi exclusives or new 3DS exclusives. Probably the DSi exclusives, because the new 3DS exclusives, there was at least some desirable content there. There's very little DSi specific content to speak of.
Well, I might have pirated Contra Rebirth, and I'm not sorry.
That's not a DSi game.
Okay, well that's Nintendo Ish. The Wii Shop channel. Game, yeah. Yeah, but yeah. That's what I thought he was kind of referring to in general, just WiiWare and digital only.
No, he's talking specifically about like under-supported like Nintendo hardware upgrades. The Switch 2 is not really in the same category.
Okay.
Like the Switch 2 is just a full, complete hardware refresh, like PS4 to PS5. I wanted to bring this up because it's very funny. So they're putting Mario Paint on the Super Nintendo Switch Online.
Joy-Con has mouse capabilities.
Yeah,
there
and
you go.
It actually does utilize the Joy-Con mouse.
That's awesome.
Cool. And if you're on the original Switch, you can actually plug in a USB mouse.
Oh.
And I think that's also true of the Switch 2, obviously, but...
That's neat.
Can you play that game with the flies and the fly swatter and the...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, I want to do that.
And then you can also... they also went back and patched mouse controls into Mario Picross.
Okay.
Nice.
Kind of neat.
What is Picross?
Speaking of Mario Paint, like, I need to fuck around a bit with the DK Artist sub-mode that's just buried in Bonanza's menus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They
told
me
about
that.
With that.
Yeah, it's a post-game feature, and it popped up, and I'm like, I need to figure that out.
I don't even think it's post-game. I just think, like, because I definitely had characters telling me about it before I finished.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah, it's just that, like, it's not obvious that it's there at first. But, yeah, it's a really weird, interesting thing that seems to potentially be, like, sort of calling back to some really ancient shit, like Mario Artist Polygon Studio. But yeah, interesting. But yeah, like that was kind of cute that they went in and like they patched that and they added USB mouse support. It's a lot of cool stuff.
But I want to play Mario Teaches Typing and plug in a USB keyboard. Damn it!
No, you don't. Stop that.
I don't think Nintendo actually owns that lock, stock, and barrel as a thing.
No, I played it as a kid because I grew up in a rich town that had a good computer lab. They had Apple computers, and I got to play the Amazon Trail, not the Oregon Trail, and got to play Mario Teaches Typing. And then we moved to one town over, and man, they were like a year behind, and they had garbage computers. Yeah.
Okay, so a few things. So Mario Teaches Typing was neither developed nor published by Nintendo.
Oh, real quick, it's showing me an ad for Twisted Metal Season 2, and it looks fucking badass. Sorry.
That is a sentence I never thought I'd hear in my life.
Mario Teaches Typing was developed and published by Interplay.
Wow.
So whoever owns that is... Like, I have no idea who would technically own that after Interplay's bankruptcy. So you're probably never going to see that ever again. Not that anyone's surprised, but I figured I would bring up one of the legal reasons why that's not going to happen. I'm going to say Boktai 3 is getting a new English translation that not only finishes all the bits and pieces left untranslated, but also has some of the original voice actors from 1 and 2 reprising their role. I would imagine they just have little voice dialogue shouts. That's kind of neat. Sabata's Counterattack did not come out in English. For those who are aware of the Boktai games, we got 1, 2, and 4.
Oh,
it was weird.
That was weird.
And 4 they tried to pretend was not a Boktai game. They called it Lunar Knights. It was on the DS.
Oh, that game.
Yeah, there's fascinating things about Boktai in terms of why it came to be in the way that it was. Let's see, I saw some old... okay. Yeah, this was interesting, because I remembered reading an article about it like a month ago or something. The reason Boktai ended up happening was that Konami's toy division had a bunch of like cheap UV detectors that they had like gotten hold of for some sort of toy that had just never happened. And so Kojima like put together a pitch for that game just based on I think I can do something with these.
Well, that's neat.
Yeah, that's smart. That's smart use. Okay. Another one in the question list. If you look at 90s gaming magazines, both official art and fan art of FF7 had a lot of anime aesthetics to them, both as a trend of the time and how the junky PS1 graphics were meant to be. How much did Advent Children and the compilation of FF7 change people's perception about how the FF7 cast should look? Like, what I would say is that I don't think they changed that much. Like, the rendering style is obviously quite different from the 2D art, but the 2D art really kind of always set up what their proportions actually looked like. Like, if you looked at the art that was actually in the manual, that was just like, here's some, like, finalized key art from, like, Nomura or someone, they just kind of look like that. Like, and the general aesthetics of the backgrounds also probably kind of slid them into that more realistic look. Like, you get a lot of the heavy industrial aesthetic of FF7 kind of ends up lending itself to that, along with the game's general kind of bleak tone. So I think that, especially given that a lot of the people involved with Advent Children were people involved with FF7, I think that ultimately, like, the art that existed at the time was probably more down to what people were capable of rendering and what was popular in the aesthetic, as opposed to something that was specific to how people perceived FF7's aesthetic to be. Because certainly I, as a player at the time, like, thought of it as much less stylized. Like, I was always confused when I saw art that leaned into more like 90s anime depictions, because, like, to me, like, at the time, my perception was the CG cutscenes. Like, that was the true perception of the characters, as far as my child brain imagined it. I asked the previous question because in a recent conversation I had with a Love and Deep Space player, they pointed how much some Otome fans were desperate for an Otome game with semi-realistic human-like characters, basically metrosexual men, and I haven't heard that phrase in decades, more ethereal than K-pop idols. Last month I asked about people who think that just because a JRPG has an anime aesthetic, that it's immature and low budget. Do you think that conversation above comes from the same place? I mean, I think you also end up with, like, you have to consider the desires of the audience of a Bishojo or Otome game. Like, you know, like, looking at opposite ends of the theoretical spectrum there, but people in romance subgenres generally end up pining for... realistic is not always the right term, but, like, definitely something that is less overt in its cartoonishness. I think that there ends up being a desire for something that at least more directly acts as simulacrum of human, even if it's often like a very like stylized and idealized human. I definitely think that the mainstream aesthetic is also always going to go for, at the very least, stylized realism, as sad as that can be. But I think that like it needs to be considered what the audience is trying to get out of it. And with FF7, like, one of the things that I think people were drawn to was that despite the game having a lot of comedic relief, it was a game that generally took itself quite seriously in most circumstances. Like, when you got to the main plot, there's a lot of comedic relief, but the comedic relief exists to try to avoid the game becoming miserable, because a lot of what's actually happening and the state of the world is bad. And when the general perceived core tone of something is serious, people gravitate more towards, like, at the very least, stylized realism. And so with FF7, I think that the, at least my general perception of the series at the time was that the true version of it was this stylized realism as filtered through the mind of a child staring at these CG cutscenes. Let's see. Conversely, certain Otome games, especially Love and Deep Space, played a lot into the idol/Oshi angle and parasocial relationship. Do you think that a character that looks a bit more realistic helped with that immersion? Oh, yeah, we haven't gotten to that, but yes. VTubers have anime avatars, but they act like humans. You can't expect the same level of engagement from a game character, even when powered by AI. Yeah, you can kind of get away with the more human something acts, the more you can get away with abstracting it. And, you know, it's very hard to, in a pre-written context, get as real as just there's a human on the other end, regardless of how they're represented. So that's what you kind of end up at. Let's see. Are we doing that? Close down to... Yeah, Joel, question one. Am I the only person who rewatched Seinfeld and finds it depressing? And Curb Your Enthusiasm really has that sense of emergency that you talk about. I think it would depend upon how you approached it.
Yeah, I mean, I've rewatched a lot of episodes and I still laugh.
Well,
I've been watching Frasier and The X-Files, and just today I saw that Mad About You is on Hulu. I watched the first two episodes, and I started thinking about Friends and Seinfeld, and just like, wow, they had like those apartments that they live in would be what, like $3,000-$4,000 a month now? You know what I mean? It's wild.
Yeah, I mean, those were like, even at the time, that was stretching plausibility. That's only become more implausible with time.
I don't know. I've never felt depressed while watching Seinfeld. I thought that every episode was about nothing and still had something to offer. I don't know.
You kind of have to approach it from the notion of, like, the four assholes that are not, that while funny, are not really worthy of human empathy.
No.
Like, if you don't approach it from that perspective, I could see eventually finding it a little... taxing, especially if you'd just sat through a bunch of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which is just that turned to 11.
Yeah, I didn't watch much of Curb Your Enthusiasm because it's like, it's just the misadventures of Larry David trying to play himself, and it's like, I don't know.
What if Seinfeld was about George, but also more cantankerous?
Pretty good.
Infamously, fucking Jason Alexander going up to Larry David after reading a script and being like, I can't get inside this character's head. No one would do this. no one would react this way and no one would do this. And Larry David just responding with like, that did happen and that is how I reacted. That's when Jason Alexander realized, like, oh, I'm playing him. what can I say? George is getting upset.
Summer George!
Like Summer Falcon.
Renanina! Yeah,
yes, I mean, I cursed Summer Falcon.
These pretzels are making me thirsty.
By basing it on that.
Square Enix had a gacha game called Schoolgirl Strikers that ran 4 years when the sequel came out. It's only recently been announced to end its service after going on for 7 years. Even more surprising is that Square Enix has said that they would make an offline version to preserve Schoolgirl Strikers 2 when even their dead FF and DQ gacha games didn't get that treatment. What do you think about games that never left Japan and have low profits, but also low maintenance cost and possibly some C-suite backing it? I mean, it's a little sad they don't leave Japan, but I mean, like, I think that the happy ending for any given gacha game is to be preserved in an offline version without the microtransaction. Like, that is the heaven for gacha games. All of the others are cast into the void and their souls destroyed upon death.
Is that Atelier game that's coming out this fall? A former gacha game?
I think it's some kind of reconstituted gacha. And of course, Capcom did the Mega Man X dive offline. So you very occasionally we get lucky and see this where like something is like, hey, instead of throwing the source code of this into a volcano, we have reconstituted it into a game that is not horrendous conceptually. Square Enix has done this very occasionally with other weird, obscure gotchas. There was Space Invaders X Arkanoid or something. Because they technically own Taito. Arkanoid versus Space Invaders. Which, like, at some point it was some sort of weird gotcha, and eventually like, it was... It found its way out of that hell and became like a paid app and was actually preserved properly by being ported to consoles with Space as part of Space Invaders Invincible Collections and Space Invader Forever. So, you know, there's the rare happy ending for these like mobile gachas where they get like reconstituted into games that don't need to be live service bullshit forever. Even if it's kind of sad that, like, you know, it would be nice if, say, Dissidia Opera Omnia, Dragon Quest Tact, like, some of these things that, like, clearly had a fan base, had a lot of work put into them, and then, or, like, Mobius Final Fantasy for another one, like, it'd be nice to see some of those get reconstituted into actual video games, instead of being consigned to, being tossed into the volcano.
The only gacha game I really got sucked into was I think it was Sega Heroes. So just a match
Heroes.
No. But no, just a match 3 puzzle game, but you got characters from all different games, and I remember getting what's her name? Tyrus from Golden Axe or Tyra. Yeah, I remember getting her as, like, a rare, like, super rare drop, and she was, like, so good, and she just annihilated everything, and it was like, oh. Like, I didn't even know what a gacha game was while I was playing it, and after I had bought a couple of the, like, $5 packs or whatever, and it was like, oh, I see what's happening here. I got really lucky and got this really rare character, and now the game is actually possible. Okay. Got it. And then they added like Altered Beast characters, and I'm like, what the hell did you do that for? That was a weird game. But I learned who Cream and Cheese were, and some other obscure Sonic characters I'd never seen before. Well. Anyways.
But, yeah, it's one of those things, like,
in the chair.
I hope it becomes more common for gacha games to get reconstituted into actual video games by the time that they're they reach end of life. But I don't suspect it will ever become something that is just consistently the way things are done. Let's see. Another weird thing. Gacha games. Brave Exvius was like their most or second most successful gacha game, and yet the global version announced end of service in 2024, even while the Japanese version announced the fifth season of the game. It's the same thing with the spin-off War of the Visions. For how ruthless SE can be about canceling gacha games, they do grant some games the grace to finish the story. Yeah, I mean, I would suspect that, like, I get the sense that, like, the gacha games that are popular here and the gacha games that are popular in, like, East Asia, they probably, there's some correlation between them, but not a really, not as direct a correlation as they'd like, and so you end up with a lot of games that, like, are, like, there's a, you get things that, like, they end service significantly earlier in one territory or another, because that's just, they just do better in their home territory or something like that, and that's probably frustrating. I can't even imagine. Final Fantasy is Square Enix's flagship and experimental series. DQ is the flag bearer of JRPG. Octopath and Bravely are throwbacks. Saga is Kawazu's favorite child, and Front Mission is for milking the model kits. Where does that leave Mana? I think that's something they've been trying to figure out for years. With Visions, I think they kind of slotted it into this, like, the not light, but breezier action RPG space. Like, that sort of felt like where Visions planted its flag as being what the Mana series is. It's like, it's not bereft of gravitas, but it's a lighter thing than, like, your typical Final Fantasy. Joe, you might have more to say on that, as having more recently played Visions of Mana.
Right, well, because I've spent so much time talking about Donkey Kong, I'll mention again, I have been playing Visions of Mana on the RP Gamer Twitch channel on Tuesday and Thursday nights, and I've gotten to the point where, so something happened in the story where they kind of revealed what's really going on, and I'm in the late game, and now I gotta take out all the Benevedons, and I don't know. Let me see what he was saying here. So where does that leave Mana? I don't know, because to me, like, Mana to me just comes off as Dragon Quest with action combat instead of turn-based, you know, and it has a very similar aesthetic and art style and atmosphere to it.
Maybe that's actually what it should be then. Just, hey, this is our traditional action RPG.
Yeah, that's what I would say. Sure.
Like, Final Fantasy continued to experiment and be more meat and potatoes action RPG.
Yeah, so Final Fantasy is their opportunity to really, like, you have entries like 15, 16 that were meant to be the most graphically impressive that they could be, but then you have more experimental spin-offs, sure. Like, World of Final Fantasy was kind of a, you know, Pokemon-style game. So he mentioned, you know, Front Mission is for milking model kits. Well, I would love to get some PVC figures of characters from Visions of Mana. That would be cool.
Yeah, that could work.
You know, or amiibos, or no, there wouldn't be amiibos, but I don't. But not actually, yet, somebody
maybe if we get lucky and we get a Visions of Mana support ride.
Right. Somebody told me that, oh, no, there's no way there's ever going to be a Switch 2 port of Ends of Mana, and I don't know.
Why?
I would put it on the less likely end just because of what happened to the developer. NetEase. It's not impossible. Well, like, NetEase owned them. I forget what the studio's actual name was, but yeah. Square Enix ended up absorbing some of that studio. They clearly weren't displeased with the product.
I mean, it's an Unreal Engine product, right? That should,
I think,
make
so
a port less difficult.
Yeah, it's not impossible. I think that the timing is just off for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see it running on Switch, but Switch 2 could definitely run it.
Oh, Switch 2 it absolutely could. It ran on PS4. It can run on Switch 2.
So then.
Was there a PS4 version in Japan?
Visions? I was pretty sure.
Yeah, I thought it was. I don't know. I thought it was Xbox One and Series X.
It came out on PS4.
Okay.
Didn't it? Yeah, it was PS4. I thought it was a dual generational release. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it didn't come out on Xbox One, but it did come out on PS4.
Well, one funny thing is there's a status ailment called Moogled, and yes, you get turned into a Moogle. And every time it happens, I'm like, wrong. Yeah, I'm like, wrong game.
That's not new, dude.
It's not, but every time it happens, it's my first time seeing it because I didn't play the other Mana games. But I'm always like, wrong game. They don't even go here. They're not even in this.
you should. Well, I don't actually think the original Mana game actually holds up terribly well. But you should maybe go back and take a look at that because. The Moogle status effect dates back to that very first one, Seiken Densetsu Final Fantasy Gaiden, which also has a chocobo in it as a compulsory, like, you cannot get without riding a chocobo.
Yeah, so then to his other point, so basically Mana is competing with Ys. I wouldn't say that. I don't know. I would say that to me, Trials of Mana, the remake, and Visions of Mana, those are the only two that I really played. Those both, to me, seem like Square's answer to Tales of, you know? They really feel more like Tales of Arise or something like that, in my opinion.
Hello. I can see the modern Ys comparison, just because, like, if you play something like an Ys 8 or 9, it's a little bit like a faster-paced Mana.
Yeah, that's true. Because you actually get the three party members. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Man, I really hope we get an announcement of Proud Nordics in the U.S. soon. I was just reading an interesting interview with the head of Falcom on one of our fine competitors.
RPG site.
They had an interview with, I believe, the president of Falcom, where he was sort of talking about how they were fighting so hard to try to get the English-speaking world caught up in terms of Trails releases, and they're very happy that with. Beyond the Horizon coming early next year, that will be them finally having reached that point where there is parity. And, you know, with them talking about how much they want to have parity between Japan and overseas releases, that does, like, please, Proud Nordics, I want to play Proud Nordics. But yeah, so what's this current one? There's a Hayao Miyazaki quote about how much he hated some Japanese voiceover work because the character's voice is preachy and high-pitched. But then there are also tons of Western anime fans who eat that stuff up. Is there any case you can think of where you think a foreign singer or voice actor, etc., sounds good, but then realize that you only think so because you don't understand the language and how it's normally spoken? I don't, like, usually I don't question it too hard. Like, I understand that, like, there's a degree to which I'm just, like, it's all vibes. It's all vibes. Does the vibe work?
Honestly,
and, like, that's awesome.
Honestly, for me, this question works better in the reverse for Japanese students who just kind of accept the listening tests voice acting. because anybody who is any good at English understands immediately that, oh man, this voice, whoever they hired to do these voiceovers for the tests were awful. In the years before AI voiceover work, even.
Oh, Lord.
So. Yeah, I mean, many years ago, I was doing an Aiken, high-level Aiken test prep with some elementary school students for whom this test was definitely not intended, but they were that good. And for the listening section, the only strategy I could really provide was don't laugh during the listening section. it was really awful.
Well, Shadow Labyrinth just really reminds me of Salt and Sanctuary.
Definitely got a bit of that.
Deeply different.
Okay. Like, I'm just saying, just the visual style, the animation. Oh,
yeah, and I can see that.
A little bit of jankiness here and there. Oh, yeah.
Fuck me.
Wonder how Ninja Gaiden Ragebound ends up turning out.
Yeah, that's the Game Kitchen. I'm gonna buy it. I think it looks neat.
What's their fucking? It was. Is that Blasphemous from them?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Blasphemous. Yeah, I'm interested in how that turns out.
Maybe you should do your air dash when you get low enough to get on that platform, so you don't hit the wall.
It just. Okay.
That worked out. See? Great.
Fuck. How did I fuck with
and
that
then
jump?
You died anyways.
I just blew an easy jump. Look, I did it again. Oops, I did it again. No. Fucking suck at this game.
Please stop committing crimes against meter.
It also reminds me of Ori a little bit too.
I think that's a better comparison than Soul and Sanctuary. Like I get what you're saying with the art style, but like that's more of like 2D Souls, 2D Dark Souls, whereas this is very much more leans more on the Metroid side of the Metroidvania scale.
Did you play Salt in Sacrifice?
Here's
the thing. I love Salt in Sanctuary because it was like a 2D Souls-like Castlevania kind of thing. But the thing is that Salt and Sacrifice went in more of like a Monster Hunter, Demon Souls direction, and you might actually like that one better because like there are these mages you have to kill, and it's kind of like Monster Hunter. Like they'll tell you where they are, and you got to track them down, and then they run away while you're fighting them, and it's wild. Yeah.
Why would I want to kill mages? It's awful.
Well, they're evil mages, and. Mm. They're jerks, and you have to kill them to open up certain doors. But anyways, you might want to check that one out. I think you'd like it. I didn't care for it that much. Ooh. All right. Sorry, what were you talking about? Sorry.
Yeah, I'm just hitting a few more of these before we clock out for the night.
Okay.
Dave, care to guess what the time is on in Stars and Time right now?
God, I forgot where we were last week. I think we were
700 hours.
800 hours that time.
Well, a little FYI, there is no upper limit on the clock here.
Oh, geez.
Let's bet big. Let's go 1100.
You didn't bet big enough.
Oh, no.
Jeez.
1,204 hours.
Oh, no.
Oh, my God. I had thought to myself 1,200, and then I was like, oh, that's going too far, and knocked it down to 1,100.
Yeah. Well, when I first got Scarlet Nexus on Series X, it was like, you know, if you kept it in quick resume, the clock kept going, so... That game thinks that I played hundreds of hours and I didn't.
This isn't an uncommon thing. It's just keep in mind that I started this game on July 3rd.
Wow.
That was, that was, 28 days ago now?
Yep.
Yeah, 1,200 hours is 50 days.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's going weird. A lot faster than it should be.
That's weird. Okay.
Yeah.
And we've known that since the beginning, because at around the 52-hour mark of having this thing actually in the machine, mostly in sleep mode, it was giving me 150 hours.
Yeah, it seems to be going somewhere between twice and three times as fast as reality.
That's weird. Yeah.
But again, this is a game about a not very unstable time loop. So
fitting in its way.
Yes. If I actually manage to get around to doing a review of this, I'm just going to say, yeah, this is a bug. It's a funny bug, but you know, I'm choosing to consider this an unintentional feature.
That's what all bugs are, undocumented features.
I mean, all bugs that don't immediately destroy things.
Okay. Okay, some quick ones to get out of the way. One big reason why it's so hard for new Magical Girl anime to make a splash comes down to you getting a new Precure every year. Same story with many sports games or online FPS. Which other examples can you think of? A really dominant player in an annualized or near annualized franchise.
The thing is, I mean, it's that there are multiple other Magical Girl anime or manga series every year. I can think of several. Mm. It's just that the genre itself has been suffering fatigue for most of a generation.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, Precure is holding down the very traditional format of
Magical Girl. Yeah, you gotta do something weird.
So there have been plenty of weird ones, especially in the manga series that haven't made it to anime. A lot of them went a little too weird at times. Honestly, I think the main market for non-Precure Magical Girl anime kind of peaked with Madoka Magica, just because it's so incredibly meta-intensive for playing with the viewer's expectations.
Mm-hmm.
But there are series outside, Japanese and non-Japanese series that are popular over here that are definitely within that genre style.
Mm-hmm. There is something to be said for, like, a particularly successful example of the genre sucking the air out of the room.
Yeah. It's not a dead genre, it's just no longer the boom genre.
But one thing I'll bring up in response to the original question is, like, we've over time, like, we've talked about this a number of times, but, like, simulation sports games, like, there's room for only one, even when the license is not actually tied up with anyone.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that would be the easiest example of this. Like, you look at I think a lot about how, like, there used to be other MLB games. There aren't anymore. And that was such a problem for the MLB that they, like, essentially browbeat Sony into releasing it on other platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And like, that is, you know, it wasn't that it was literally impossible to make an MLB game. Like, you could absolutely get the license. There was a few years where there was, like, there was just RBI Baseball on Switch.
Those games are apparently terrible.
Yeah, I believe it. But, like, they existed because it was just, we want something that could be on every platform. And then, you know, eventually those went away. Because they were developed by MLB Advanced Media.
I think that's the company that makes such games as No Games. I think they're the people that do the MLB streaming app.
Yeah, like the only reason those RBI baseball games were being made was that, like, Well, we don't want the only MLB game to be platform exclusive. We don't want that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, over time, they just like forced their like that branch to make these, and it's just like, what?
I can't believe you're fighting a giant turkey named Duke Sirius.
That has to be a reference to something.
Yeah.
Why so serious?
Okay, moving on. But yeah, I think sports games are the easiest exemplifier of this. And like, you run into other, like, even when there's an obvious differentiating factor, this can prove difficult to do. Like, you know, there's the obvious, like, to, because wrestling's on the brain. You know, WWE 2K comes out every single year, and it kind of steamrolled, it kind of ended up steamrolling, the AEW game. Like, that I saw no traction for after it came out, because when you look into something like that, you run into the competition is more like, if you're trying to break into an existing a new sport, you run into the issue of your first crack at it, it's probably going to feel bare bones and kind of shitty, because you're just getting all the systems in place to be able to iterate on and fix. And if you have competition in that realm, it's very hard to get people to jump ship to try your new attempt at the franchise that has bugs and missing features and feels bare bones compared to the competition that has been iterating and iterating for years and years and years. So that's a bunch with NBA 2K being the dominant force and EA repeatedly trying to make basketball happen, and just like, in the early 10s, it was just like a fucking like comedy of errors, as they just tried and tried and tried to make these happen, and just ended up throwing up their hands and canceling them over and over and over again. And then, you know, they eventually successfully launched NBA Live, and then relaunched it, and then guess what? That ended up fizzling out anyway, because it was impossible to unseat the existing, like, the NBA 2K franchise. They just ended up giving up. They don't make NBA Live games anymore. I think sports are particularly vulnerable to this.
But I want to play NFL Blitz, damn it.
Too bad.
I want to play Wayne Gretzky's 3D hockey.
Why?
The actual NFL does not... was also a factor in Blitz's demise, just by dint of the fact that, like... when real life scrutiny was coming down on football, it's like, hey, this does horrible things to people. Like, you know, people getting lifelong injuries, paralyzed, like all sorts of shit. The NFL looks at NFL Blitz and it's like, this is like a video game where football players get hit that like are fucking essentially doing pile drivers to each other. Maybe we don't want this. And that's why shortly before that unlicensed for a few years, you had NFL Blitz Pro. Anyone remember this?
No.
Blitz Pro was a PS2, Xbox, GameCube NFL Blitz that like tried to dial back all of the horrible violence.
Oh.
And it was just sort of like, you know, the general consensus response was, why would we play NFL Blitz if it's not going to be arcadey and insane? Mm. And I don't think anyone ever quite figured out the answer to that.
Okay.
But Blitz League is pretty cool if you never played that.
I did see a game on Steam called, like, I think it was like Super Blood Hockey, and it was just, it looked like NES hockey, but there's just bloody pixels everywhere. I thought that was kind of funny. I don't know.
Oh, the Mutant League Steam game turned out. I forget what that was actually called. Mutant League
Football. And hockey.
Mutant Football League. That was what they ended up calling it. They just swapped league and football's position. But yeah, I guess it did well enough to get console ports at some point, but I don't think they ever made a sequel. Oh, they did announce Mutant Football League 2. And it entered early access last year.
Sweet.
So Mutant Football League 2 is in development. Huh. Wow.
I have a suggestion. Maybe wait till you're almost dead and out of healing items before you turn on the Mech Warrior transformation.
I don't think that's really going to make a difference.
Okay. You just can't seem to beat the giant turkey.
No, this is the second time I fought this thing, and the pattern's different now, so I just gotta figure it out.
All right. Anyways.
Okay.
I mean, I tried to play MLB The Show like once, and I'm like, this is more boring than real baseball. Wow.
That's absurd.
Go for a Power Pro Kun Pocket instead.
Guess that, or
what was the goofy one we were playing on Switch? What's it called again?
That was Power Pro game.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that one. That was cool. I like
bobbleheads. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a fun U.S. made one too. I forget the name of it, but it's more arcadey.
But we actually got to cover one on the old site because it actually had a role playing game back end. So. I need to track that one down sometime just to see what it was actually like. I just had to cover it in Japandemonium years ago.
Yeah. Okay, my voice is starting to give out, so I would like to hear about reading material where I would not have to talk.
Mm-hmm. Okay, As luck would have it, I was actually reminded of one of the items to promote today. And we have Tanuki as a Teapot, Animal Tales from Japan. And in one of the sections, I just randomly talk about how, like, troops of monkeys in Japan will find persimmon trees out in the forest and just take bites out of each fruit to try and find which ones are sweet. So today, while escorting a bunch of elementary school kids to a pottery barn, out the back window there was a small forest. It was out in the countryside, and there was a persimmon tree, and there were, in fact, two monkeys in the tree sampling the goods, which served as a very good distraction for the kids when we needed them to not be touching the clay for a bit. All good. So, yay. Life imitates short stories here. Yes, Tanuki is a Teapot by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu. Japanese folktales and random observations. With illustrations, again, by me, because I could. That's kind of the point. and that we have Instances of the Pizza Parlor, which I need to get that last side story up so that it will, in fact, be 14 ebooks. Actually, 15 ebooks. I'm losing count. Oh, no. 15 ebooks. Soon to be 5 paperback collections available as of Friday this week. If you would like a Dead Tree version, I'm not going to insist upon it. I usually do this just so I have a copy in print. So we're not at War and Peace yet for length, but we're getting there. Wish me luck.
I have confidence you can make it.
Yep. Other than that, I have Actually, I have something on Royal Road right now, Mermaid Story. Again, under Michael Yatimizu. So that's something to check out if you're ever on Royal Road. And also Vainglorious Long Is the Night for Lit RPG. I've got stuff in all over the place at this point. So if you're interested in the Lit RPG genre and would like to see an attempt at doing a Metroidvania-styled one, that's mine. Again, Vainglorious Long Is the Night.
That's what the Bob Ross emoji was. Sorry.
Really? Okay. Not getting
the joke. He did the thing I told him to do, and then I put in the Bob Ross emoji, and then he wrote, "Thanks for not saying I told you so." And I'm just like, "Well, okay."
Yeah, but no one listening to the podcast could have seen the Bob Ross.
That's true. Gift. Okay.
Okay. I'm highly confused at this point, but only a degree more than usual. Okay, anyway, so please make my summer. Go read some stuff, maybe purchase some copies, or just Kindle. I mean, this is all on Kindle Unlimited as well.
You will be getting
somebody reading it all right now.
At least one copy of Collection 4, because I will be buying it.
Yay, thank you very much. Yes. Thank you. And that I do have one other item coming up under the name Michael Spearwater, just because I can. And if you just Google that, it's probably going to be about the only thing you're going to find. But it's a travelogue romanticy, and it is nothing like anything else I've written. And for various reasons that should be pretty obvious by the end of the second chapter, I don't want much of an audience crossover with my young adult fiction. So, I challenged myself to write this thing. But yeah, that's going to be up at the end of the week as well.
And,
but one thing that won't be up much longer is, because I'm going on family vacation starting Friday, so I probably will not be available next week.
Gotcha. Yeah.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Have a good vacation.
Yeah.
I mean, if hopefully the rumored Nintendo Direct shows up, we'll have
plenty to ramble about.
Yeah.
And Joe, where can we find you?
You can find me on, let's see, Blue Sky, Twitch, and YouTube. So Joey at smokeandjoegamer.bsky.social, twitch.tv/smokeandjoegamer, and YouTube also smokeandjoegamer86, I think, something to that effect. I'm also, a staff member at RP Gamers. You can talk to me on the Discord RP Gamer server. And apparently, according to Pause the Boss and the Frogman, looks like I'm going to be continuing to stream on RP Gamer even when JRPG July is over.
Yay!
So the plan is to keep doing Vengeance of the Mana till I beat it. Then that's I'm going to keep the same time slots, so Tuesday and Thursday night, 10 p.m. to 12 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. So you can watch those streams. But I had suggested possibly doing some Donkey Kong Bonanza post-game content, even though there would be some spoilers, because I was arguing on the server that it counts as a JRPG as far as I'm concerned. But I'm like, it's made in Japan. It's got RPG elements. I mean, it's more RPG-ish than Zelda or Monster Hunter, and they cover those games.
Yeah, Final Fantasy 16.
Yeah, that too. And so, yeah, but I mean, I also have plenty of RPGs, some of which are JRPGs, some of which are not. So, I mean, I could be streaming Metaphor, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, Unicorn Overlord, I got a bunch of games, Dragon Age... The Veil Guard, I could play that. That's an RPG. So, I have this idea that I'm going to, stream RPGs on the RP Gamer channel, obviously, but also still use my channel to do whatever I want. And I haven't done any new like, I haven't really been doing any Twitch streams on my channel, and I haven't been done a lot of new YouTube videos, but I'd still like to balance that out with the RP Gamer streaming. So, you know, stay tuned to those channels, and maybe you'll see something. We'll see. I might still do Sega Saturdays or Switch 2 Saturdays or something. So that's fine. Yeah, and that's where you can find me. And I am trying to cut back on social media time, just staring at the phone too much. But, you know, I'm on Blue Sky if you want to follow me there. And I picked up 6 new followers recently on Blue Sky, and only 3 were porn accounts. Wow.
Amazing.
What a thought.
What a world.
That's amazing. So, anyways, yeah, please consider liking, subscribing, following, commenting, whatever, you know, the contextual thing is. And, yeah. Check that out.
Are you still on Mastodon?
No, I deleted that. The whole time I was on there, I got like 3 followers, and it was you 3. So,
yeah, I just never figure out what to do with that particular one.
There just weren't enough people, and you would see the same people posting over and over again, and, you know, no followers, no engagement. It's like, what am I doing here? Like,
because it's social media for Linux nerds.
It really is. Like,
it is. Yes. Yes.
You got to be like a Linux programmer and a super far left progressive on top of it to get any engagement on there. And Blue Sky, you just have to be liberal, you know, or left of center even, and it's fine. And there's like 35 million people, and I have like 110 followers now. It's like, hey, this is fun. You know, I just wish I could get more followers on platforms that I can monetize. Wink, wink.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Yeah, seriously. But at least on the RP Gamer channel, I may get 7 or 8 viewers and 2 chatters, and I'm like, that's what I wanted. This is fine.
I just wanted to see people to see what I was doing.
Yeah. So I've talked to Hero Harmony, I've talked to Mon Cappy, I've talked to No Bake, has been on, Scar jumped in once, Paws jumped in once, yeah, so it's been pretty cool.
All good people.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, so give that a look. Give that a watch. We've now got a member of the stream team involved.
Hooray.
But otherwise, you can catch us when we stream typically Mondays at 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, or Sundays at midnight Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific. For podcast recording on Mondays and shenanigans nonsense on Sundays. I think this week me and Wheels might end up playing some Wild Hearts, yeah. Unless Joe and Wheels want to play some of the update to Marvel Rivals. I can't remember if that's out yet.
We'll probably do a little both, I would guess. We'll start with Wild Hearts and then and then play some Marvel at the end.
Yeah, that sounds like a plan. You know, so that's the thing. If I end up being late or something, then, you know, you guys would just be playing Wild Hearts, and then we'll do a few Marvel Rivals. We got to check out Phoenix and Blade, I think, are both in there now.
Is Blade already in there?
I think so. I haven't checked, but... Yeah.
Let us not contemplate Kevin Feige showing that he has absolutely no idea what the appeal of Blade is. You saw that?
I did not
interview
see...
quote?
No.
Yeah.
He was talking about how they'd gone through 4 Blade scripts because they didn't just want him to be like a guy dressed in leather killing vampires.
Like, but that's what he is.
That's what exactly he is. That's the only thing anyone wants from him.
Wesley Snipes nailed the part. He knew what was expected of him.
I mean, I
nailed
sure
it so well that they brought him back for a completely
for a cameo.
Movie.
Yeah,
he was awesome. Yeah. And
he was still awesome.
Yes.
Like, I'm not gonna lay this at the feet of like new cast Blade actor Mahershala Ali. I think that he can do it. I think he could do a great Blade.
Mahershala
but
Ali
I think
is
that
the bomb. He would be an amazing Blade.
Yeah, like he is the one they casted for the role. He has been sitting around waiting for them to get off their ass and actually commit to a goddamn script.
Maybe he can kill Morbius, you know.
Let's not even bother.
Yeah, let's just not even bother with Morbius.
No more Jared Leto and superhero movies.
No longer, I remember that
particular plot line from the old Spider-Man TV show in the 90s where they actually had Blade trying to hunt down Morbius at one point.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, but broadly speaking.
But then Morbius convinced them that, no, he wasn't actually bad, and they teamed up with Black Cat and went and did adventures.
But whenever I think about current Blade, I'm just like, there is no need to complicate this. But yeah, other than that, you can ask us questions. You can ask us questions as Fireminer did if you catch us when we're streaming. Otherwise, you can ask them. Excuse me. You can ask them in the comments section on rpgamer.com, or you can ask them to us in the Discord, which you can get an invite to by going to the community tab of rpgamer. If you put questions in the podcast section, we will assume they are for us unless they are addressed to someone else. And even if they're addressed to someone else, we might answer them anyway if they're interesting. But we always like getting questions. Thanks once again to Fireminer for always keeping us with plenty of things to answer for. But otherwise, I think that wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
See you.
See you.